Oh, thanks. Yeah, never thought I would talk about Eclipse stuff on a Microsoft thing. So
That's a good thing.
things change, yeah. Okay, so it's about textual DSLs and code generation. There are obviously also graphical DSLs on Eclipse, but I'm not looking at that. You can also write interpreters instead of generating code. Don't look at that too. So that's why we have this title. Before we look at the tooling, let me give you a little bit of context, what I usually do with DSLs. And that is mainly in the area of software architecture. We build what we call software architecture DSLs. What does that mean? It means that as you understand and develop your software architecture, in real time, you build a language to express architectural concepts to precisely and formally describe the system. And then, of course, you can use that language that resembles your architectural concepts directly to describe the applications. And then, of course, you use code generation and stuff to actually implement as much of it as possible. So that's where the term architecture DSL comes from. So let me give an example of what I'm talking about so you can relate to it a little bit better. Usually, it starts with components because components is such a nice term where nobody knows what it means, so you can always start with it. But of course, since you define a language that, among other things, defines the notion of component, it becomes non-ambiguous quite quickly. But it's a good starting point. So, for example, here we can very trivially describe components and which interfaces they provide and which they require. You can define interfaces. Obviously, some stuff has to go between the braces. You can then define systems by instantiating components. And that's just and connecting them. That's just an example. I mean, the point of architectural DSLs is that, as usual with DSLs, it's different basically for each system. So we built the DSL for the platform, for the product line, for the system that we want to describe. Can become a little bit less trivial, for example, using data replication, where you describe data structures and then you say that certain components publish these data structures, others use them. We have built things with pre and post conditions where you have a messaging-based interface and where you say that, for example, for this message, there is two preconditions, here is a post condition. Or we have built systems where we use protocol state machines. You probably are familiar with what that means to define the valid sequence of messages. So you've got your interface with a bunch of messages and then you put in a protocol state machine that in this case says that you can only report problems and report positions if you have previously registered the aircraft in this kind of interface. So that's the stuff I'm usually doing, and I'll, in probably a minute, let you know what kind of tools we use here. One thing that, because it was always Chris's questions yesterday, like, has anybody ever used this stuff or is it just like play tools? It's really important to, for me at least, to mention that this is really stuff you're doing on a day-to-day basis. So the slide says that currently four of my customers have this approach in use and built DSLs, probably five in the meantime, or I don't know exactly, you know, depends on what you count as current customer. But the point is that it's really something that's used in practice. And what's maybe also interesting is that the approach works for enterprise systems, and it also works for embedded systems. One of my recent customers builds firmware for deeply embedded stuff. So the target language is C, some kind of microcontroller. Other applications are more enterprise-y. And of course, the approach works in both cases. Since you build a code generator custom-built for the target system, right, no problem. And abstractions like components and data and messages always work. Okay, so that's the context. Why textual? Or, hello, why not graphical? I mean, you probably discussed about that at some point. In my view, the point is that languages and editors are much more easier to build, much more easier. that means that you can build the language and simple editors in real time. I do architecture workshops where we, you know, like spike a system and think about how you want to build it, and we build the architectural language in real time. I couldn't do that with graphical tools. Depends, of course, on the tools, but at least on the Eclipse platform, there is nothing where you can do that in real time. If you think Meta Edit Plus, things might be a bit different, but textual stuff really works. It's very agile, okay, if you want to use the term. Also, it integrates very well with the current infrastructure. I mean, CVS, Steve Merge, no problem, right? Same thing is true for model evolution. I mean, if you change the language and you have to evolve existing models, which are just text files, you can always fall back to using grep, which is very good if you try to go to customers and convince them to use this new DSL stuff. And you know, if you can talk to them about, in the worst case, you can use grep to do all the stuff that sounds complicated. And then, of course, real developers prefer textual notations. And that's only a joke to some extent, because the fact is, we know how we work with textual stuff. We have million lines of code systems with good IDEs. It's absolutely a way to go. Nobody knows how to do this with graphical notations. So let's look at the tooling, which is obviously the main part of the session. Just wanted to give you a little bit of background. The tooling that I use and that I want to talk about is basically Eclipse, and then a tool called Xtext and a tool called Open Architecture, where I'll give you more background on how the tools fit together and what these things mean and how they evolve and why I don't just say Eclipse at the end. Let's look at how to actually build the languages, and I'm going to show you a live demo in a couple of minutes. Just want to highlight a couple of important points before through slides. So you start by specifying a grammar to define a language. Not a big surprise, okay? As part of the Xtext framework, there's a grammar definition language, which is basically kind of EBNF, right? I mean, you basically say that a component, forget about that, has the keyword component, then there is a name, then there is other stuff, and then in the component there is a number of ports, where port is obviously another rule you call here. This is basically polymorphic. It's either a message port or a data port. And what's important and what is different from normal EBNF stuff is that you have to specify, if you, for example, if you say a component contains any number of ports, then you have to specify the name of the collection of the component into which your port objects go after parsing, right? I mean, what you do here, and I'll show that on the next slide, is you derive a meta model, an abstract syntax tree from the grammar, and an abstract syntax tree obviously has to hold all the objects that you parse from the text, and you have to define how that tree looks. So if you look at this, I hope I have the same example on the next slide. Here is the generated meta model, where you can see that the meta class component has a name and it has a collection of type port in the property ports, okay? And that is where it comes from, right? This is the property, that's the meta class.
I was just gonna ask that. And the same is happening with all the ones at the top as well.
Yeah, sure. I mean, same thing for everyone.
I'm sorry, what's the question?
The question was whether that's also happening with all the other ones.
Yeah.
And that's true. You can have multi-valued properties. You have string properties where ID is a special kind of string that doesn't require quotation marks, but instead cannot have spaces. I mean, it's basically a Java identifier kind of thing, and so on. So this is an optional thing, right? So the stuff between the parents, you can write it, you can't, whatever you want. Yeah.
So question about the vertical bars. In some cases, it looks like it's kind of.
It has two different meanings, the vertical bars. Here it means or, so either a namespace or a component or blah, 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 and then assign it to the various properties. Here it means it's basically a port is either that or that.
Yeah, it's like
so
a
it's
discriminated union type.
Right.
Or.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so in addition to deriving the meta model, which is basically, as I said, a data structure to hold the content parsed from a text file, you also get a generated grammar. In this case, it's an Antler grammar to do the actual parsing, right? You don't ever want to look at it, but it's important that you get it, because without a parser, life is tough, at least in environments like that. Then what you do as the next thing, that's actually something very new that, in case somebody has seen Xtext before, they haven't seen that. We have a new utility to specify some of the semantics of what the language means. You can specify things like scopes, you can specify some important constraints through single keywords as opposed to actually writing the constraints in our OCL kind of language, and a bunch of other things that I'm not going to talk about very much. But the ability to define scopes declaratively is very useful instead of implementing, let's say, helper functions that define which elements are visible from any given reference. I'll show that in the demo in a minute. You then specify all the other constraints that cannot be specified in the semantics thing. For example, you can say an interface, the name of an interface has to start with a capital I, right? And then that's the error message you get if you don't. Or the usual unique name crap that you say that, you know, certain elements have to be uniquely named, which is a very typical case, which is why we've added this unique names thing to this more declarative approach. Anyway, after you've specified constraints, you get an editor, and that's the whole thing. You don't just get a parser, you get the whole editor. And the editor has the usual features you want, right? You have code completion, you can customize the icons and the text and all that stuff. You get syntax coloring. You can even custom colorize certain keywords in case that's important, okay? You get real-time constraint validation. Real-time means as soon as you save, the constraints are evaluated. You get the error marker directly in the editor, and you see it down here in the Eclipse, whatever you call this, error list. You get a customizable outline. You can customize icons and text. You can also completely change the structure. So the structure of the outline does not necessarily have to correspond to the structure of the text. You can like warp it into another perspective. You can even have several different what we call viewpoints in the outline view, so you can look at your model in different perspectives or viewpoints. You have code folding, and you have things like go to definition, find references, cross file references, and of course, the whole point. Once you've specified all that stuff, you get an EMF model, the instance of your generated meta model, from the text. So what XText does is it goes from the text world into the Eclipse modeling world. And once you're in the Eclipse modeling world, you can use all, you know, millions of different model processing tools, generators, validators, simulation tools based on Eclipse EMF. So XText goes from the text world into EMF, and then you're happy, okay? Okay, so here's the general process. You specify the grammar and a bunch of properties. You feed that to the XText generator, and you get the meta model, the parser, and the generated editor plugin for Eclipse. And you can then customize that plugin by, you know, drawing different icons and, you know, changing the outline. So let's look at a demo. So I will show you the result of the finished language first. So the example case is, you know, a couple of years ago, many years ago, I was working in a hospital, and I had to import data from the mainframe into some statistics application on my PC to fake the hospital statistics. The data we got was basically structured in ways like that, right? You have a bunch of lines, and each line starts with a record identifier. Yeah? No, sorry. I don't have that fancy Microsoft Windows thing. Eclipse can't do that. Sorry. I don't want to do this. They had a problem getting this thing to run at all. I might be able to do that, but that won't change the tree. It will only change the editor. So that's only half as good. Huh? Well. It's not important that you read all this stuff in detail anyway. It's only important on the next slide, which of course isn't any bigger. But there is space left here. So people who want, right, you did the right thing. Sorry, anyway, so you have basically different kinds of records which are identified by an identifier, and then each of the records starts with a blank and then a number of comma-separated fields. And what I want to do here is I want to have a language with which I can specify the mapping from such a comma-separated stuff into basically Java Bean kind of things, right? Entities with properties. That's what I want to do. So the language that I have built allows you to do two things. It allows you to specify data structures, right? You can have a data structure called patient. It has a name of type string. It has an age, which is in this case an int with a range of 0 to 120. You can have you know, references to other data structures. And of course, the editor gives you things like go to definition. So this is a reference to the address data structure. You can go here, right, just to show off the cool tools, okay? So that part is probably quite simple. This is basically defining data structures, quite boring. The other part is the definition of the actual mapping, which is basically, it's basically a parser generator in some sense. So you specify that you first expect a P001 record, and then if you find one, what the tool does it is it creates an instance of patient and then maps the first field to the name, the second field to the first name, the third field to the birth date, and then it expects either an A001 or a V001 or a T001, and then it builds the data structure, okay? So that's the language we're talking about. Well, obviously, that's not the language. That's a program written in the language. You have to be precise. And again, you have all these nice tools that, for example, if you create an instance here, you only see the data structures you've defined up here in the data section definition. And then if you, for example, assign attributes, then you only see the attributes of the type of the instance that you've defined here. So I mean, that's basically a complete IDE for the language you're talking about here, the language we've built. So the grammar definition is, as I said, done with this xtext file. You can see that, for example, here we define a data structure. It has a keyword data and then the name. Then there is this optional isPersistent. This is actually a strange notation. It says, if the text persistent is found, then make this flag true. And the whole thing is, of course, optional, because if you don't have the persistent, the flag is false. So it's like a flag that results in a Boolean in your data structure. And then you expect attributes or references, right? A reference is basically this arrow, a name, and then this is actually a very interesting feature here. You see these brackets. This says that the type of a reference, the target type, is a reference to an existing data structure. If I wrote it like this, right, then it would expect a call of the data structure rule here. So you would like define the data structure in line in the reference, which is not what you want. What you want is to mention the name of a data structure defined somewhere else. And then that name, of course, should be automatically linked or bound to the actual object. So the point is that by using this notation, your resulting data structure, the resulting meta model, makes the type of the type property to be data structure, where in the text, of course, you write just some kind of string, which is the name of an existing data structure, and then you have the symbol table and the linking happening automatically. Very, very useful. Well, that's basically, well, more of the same, okay? And then you go to the semantics definition file where you can, for example, define the scope of things. Let's see. For example, here, when you say, if you define such, if you assign a field value to a property of an instance, which of the instances are visible here? Well, it's the instances defined in that record and in its parent. So it's like climbing up the scopes defined by these record guys recursively and collecting all the declared instances in each of them and proposing them for code completion. Yeah?
What happens when the symbols you need in the list don't follow normal lexical scoping?
The scoping is completely arbitrary. The way you do it is you have to implement a function in a basically OCL kind of language that returns those elements. Now, instead of doing that function for the typical 80% case, you can use this declarative link specification, which has declarative ways of, you know, for doing most of the scoping in the general cases, you know. So in this case, for example, the instance is basically you go to the record handler element that encloses you. You grab all the elements in its instance collection, and then you do that recursively. You know, parent, record handler, record handler, record handler, and collect the stuff. And of course, obviously, this scope definition is a special case for this kind of scenario where you do it with the lexical scoping, basically. And there are 5 or 6 other declarative scoping means. Here is one where you basically follow, where you basically navigate, you know, you follow along that reference, and then you grab everything in the property called that. It's basically a path expression. And if you want to do something different, what you do is you write custom, and then you can implement in the programming language of xtext, you can implement whatever you want. So, of course, we have nice tool integration here. You can see here this editor basically looks into the meta model and provides code completion for your meta model. So you can only specify valid things, right? You say if you define a scope for the data field and you say follow, then you see the properties of the field mapping that are available to follow along. Okay, you cannot, if you put crap in here like that, then you get an error message which says that property doesn't exist. So that's the definition of the semantics. And then once you did that, you run this generate file, and then it gives you the editor and the whole parser stuff. Defining of constraints, let's see, what do we have? 1 or 2 examples. Actually, there's probably only 1. I should have deleted that. hello. So this one, for example, says that instance names must start with a lowercase letter. Well, how do you do this? Well, you basically say that the name with a lowercase first letter should be the same as the name. In other words, it already has been a lowercase if it's the same after lowercasing the first letter. And the way these constraints work is that you basically say, here is a type, and apply this Boolean expression to all instances of the type, and if this Boolean is false, output this error message. And obviously, you can also have warnings and not just errors, right? And this editor also provides all the tool support you would expect, so you can basically put context, select the meta classes. There is some, you know, inheritance crap in it which you don't really want to see, but anyway, let's say for a field mapping error and then whatever, you can have all, you see all the properties here, so field mapping has a data field. So the editors are completely aware of the abstract syntax of your language, which is, for obvious reasons, a good thing. Well, I'm not sure if it's obvious. I like it. Might be people who think that that kind of stuff isn't necessarily important. Okay, so if you want to customize the editor, the way you do this is you go into the editor project. Well, the way it's structured is that in the language project, you have all the stuff that's like runtime relevant for the language definition that you use during parsing and stuff. And then in the editor project, there is all the stuff that concerns the UI. For example, here you can see the customization of the code completion if it cannot automatically be derived from a scoping rule. Right, because scoping influences what you show in your code completion proposal. And for example, in the editor extension file, you can define the customized labels and icons for the outline view. If you go back, I hope I didn't close it. Here you have these green bubbles and record, the string record. You basically just override the label function and then just put some expression in here that either, in case of the label, defines the text that should go here, and in case of the image, you just return the name of the icon you want to use, which has to be in the icons folder, an image file of the same name. So that's basically all you need to do, and then you get the editor. Okay? Questions so far? Yes?
Yeah. So your data processing example is kind of interesting. So when I can see many advantages over doing something like JSON processing. Mm-hmm. So when would you say that this is overkill and you should just do some simple stuff with JSON? And when would you say that this gives you a lot of advantages and you can leverage it?
Well, I guess the question is when you should use something simpler like JSON and when this kind of approach is appropriate. And I guess the thing is always, to answer that question, you have to assume a level of experience of the guy who does it with these kinds of tools. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing I'm showing here, including the code generator that we didn't look at yet, I did that in an evening, started at 6, finished, I wanted to finish at 10, finished at 12 because the parser generator was a bit non-trivial. So, but anyway, I mean, 6 hours, okay? It's not a lot of work, mm-hmm. considering that you get the whole tooling. Now, the question is, who would the users of such a thing be? If you use it yourself, you might think that a nice framework library is good enough. I mean, that's the whole discussion, right? When is a DSL appropriate and when is language internal framework kind of stuff or library good enough? The point is that building that kind of stuff is less work than you think if you have the experience. And that, of course, changes the equation when to use it. In my case, the threshold is quite low, obviously, because I don't do anything else. So it's okay, it might be the hammer and nail problem, okay? But the point is, if you're experienced, it's not a big deal. Yeah?
So in your example, you showed Xtex building the semantic model for us.
Yes. Well. So now, if I understood Martin correctly yesterday, it's this, what I'm talking about, is not a semantic model, it's the abstract syntax. Now, I would argue if you define your language in a good way, your abstract syntax is good enough to be used as a semantic model. At least that's how we do it here in 99% of all the cases. You can use an existing meta model, to use my terminology, and define a grammar for it by referencing existing meta class names explicitly in grammar definition. And if you put on your theoretician's head, you would say what you want to do is first define the meta model and then define the syntax. We changed that. Actually, the reason why we changed it, because the guy who did it changed it, okay, who built this thing. I didn't build Xtext. So that's just the way it turned out, and in practice, it's okay, because it's much more pragmatic, it's quicker, it's easier if you don't yet have a meta model, which is the case in most cases.
So how often do you need to follow the transformation into something
new? Never. I never do this. Well, Sometimes I do model transformations because I have the DSL at a different abstraction level and I map it down to something lower level. But I don't do it just to get a nicer semantic model, with one exception, and that is if you do expression languages. Because for reasons that are basically limitations of Antler and tooling, you cannot easily do left recursive grammars here, because you would need grammar actions to change the tree structure different from the grammar. You can't do it in Xtext current version. You can do it in Xtext next version, which is going to come out in June. So in that case, if I wanted to build an interpreter for an expression language, then I would build this transformation step. But that's the only case I come across. Okay, let me continue. So, by the way, we started 5 minutes late based on this clock, so I will 5 minutes longer.
Just Chris is in the hallway.
Huh?
As long as Chris is in the hallway, he goes long as well.
Somebody close the door and keep him out. Okay, so one thing, I said that, well, I'm religiously a kind of believer that textual DSLs are better for 99% of the cases compared to graphical DSLs. However, there is still sometimes a use to show things graphically. And my point is that instead of editing things graphically, just visualize. And a visualization is basically, well, yeah, that's what it says. A model-to-model transformation that creates a read-only visualization that's automatically layouted from your model. And then you can drill down. So basically, you double-click on some of the boxes in the picture, and you go back to the text file at exactly the location from which, you know, the box on which you clicked was created. So here is an example where we use GraphVis for visualization, with visualization, where in this case you have a bunch of components. They are wrapped into namespaces, and you have interfaces. You can see which components provide and require which interfaces and which data structures have reference to each other. And the way you create these pictures is, we have already built a meta model for the dot language, right? That's GraphVis configuration hacking. I mean, it's an awful language. We've abstracted that into a meta model. And so what you do is you write a model-to-model transformation from your own stuff to that stuff, and then you use an existing code generator that creates the dot language text file, which you then process to get the picture. Here is another example where we use another tool called Prefuse, which is a basically more interactive way of working with visualizations, and it has these fancy, you know, layouts. That's a prototype we've thrown away because Prefuse is not what we wanted. We are now building this with Eclipse Zest. And the thing is, because this runs in Eclipse, you can then double-click on one of those guys and go back to the text file in the place where this thing was created from. And of course, you can change the graph, you can change the layout, you can remove certain elements. If I wait for another 5 seconds, some stuff goes away. GraphVis is for creating a nice picture for the documentation PDF document. That's for interactively working with the model if you need to get an overview. So the way we work with this is you work in your textual world, you press a button, you get the picture, you orient yourself, you navigate it, you double click on one of the boxes, go back to the text, and that's how you work. And I would argue that this is 99% good enough compared to graphical editing, but it's way less work. Okay, as you said, we have this, here is the transformation in this case. We have this transformation language that can do arbitrary model-to-model transformations, where in this case you take, let's see, where do we have a it's at the bottom here. We have a complex data type, and what you do is you create a node from the data type. You set the label of the node to be the name of the type, and then you set the shape to be a parallelogram, and you set the name to whatever. So it's basically an imperative procedural language where you just create elements of the target meta model based on elements of the input meta model, and you have quite powerful ways of navigating over models. You have, you know, path expressions with multiple dots. You have things like select, map, collect, the usual higher order function kind of stuff that you have in any decent model query and manipulation language. That language is officially called Xtend, but it's basically a ripoff or an implementation of OCL. We implemented whatever we understood. We left away what we didn't understand. So funny thing is that Jos Walmer and Anneke, who invented OCL more or less, now also use this stuff, and they say it's good enough, you can call it OCL. OK, let's think a little bit about, or look a little bit at code generation. I don't want to discuss the trade-offs between code generation and interpretation. I mean, we all know there are trade-offs. And they have disadvantages, they have advantages. I find that in most of the projects I do, code generation is the better approach, and that's simply the case because if you know going back to this C stuff, you don't in an embedded system you don't want to run some kind of bottle interpreter on a microcontroller. I mean, don't even think about it. So no question. That's why in my world I usually do code. Same is true, by the way, for J2EE. If you want to use J2EE or other, you know, some of the older, somewhat crappy enterprise APIs, you have to generate all this stuff, okay? You can't interpret in a meaningful way. So you have to generate. Question? Well, by compiling it and writing unit tests against the generated, against the compiled stuff. But I don't want to go into that. I mean, I have 500 slides about all these best practices, but I don't want to discuss it now because I'm running out of time already. Right. Right, there is an integration with fitness to test OEW artifacts. Yeah, but it's a different story. So one thing, if you generate code, you want to make sure that you separate two kinds of generators. One is the generator that builds you some kind of API against which you implement the manually written code, assuming parts of your system are manually written. If you generate 100%, then obviously you don't have this manually implemented code. But the point is, this level of code generator doesn't necessarily know anything about the target platform. And if I say target platform, I don't mean target language, but I mean, is it JEE, is it Spring, is it OSGI, right? You know it's Java, but you don't know about the target technology. So that's what I call the API layer that you generate. And then in a second step, well, then you can implement the manual code without knowing the target runtime infrastructure. And then you generate the glue code, which basically maps those POJOs, plain old Java objects, by providing some kind of adapters, wrappers, all this stuff to go to the target thing. And the code generator is based on a template language called Expand. I'll show you the example. Well, I have to click once more to see the demo slide, and then I can go here. So let's first take a brief look at the code that's generated so you know what the point is. So from those data structure definitions, it's probably not a big surprise what we are going to generate, okay? We generate Java classes that have setters and getters for the properties, and for some reason they are out of sync. So you have private properties and setters and getters, okay? I mean, trivial. It's not the actual importer. Why is this? The actual importer is not quite as trivial. It's basically a generated state machine that goes through the text file and checks what, you know, which kind of record arrives and stuff. Now, here you could argue I could have done an interpreter. And I agree. I could have done an interpreter just as well. Regarding those data structures here, I could not do an interpreter, at least not if I want to use things like Hibernate or other persistence APIs with this generated Java code. You need the Java code so you can declaratively use the persistence layer to make them persistent, right? So that's why here you need a generator. For the importer, you could have done a generic interpreter engine that reads the model, but I thought since I'm already generating, I'll generate the importer too. So let's look at the code generator for the data structures because it's quite simple. It's easy to relate to. The code generator for the importer is a little bit more involved. So it's in the generator project. Oops. Yeah. Well, I should open it if I say so. And so there are three things I want to hint at. One is the template files themselves. I mean, templates are probably quite obvious. The blue stuff is stuff you generate. The purple, is it purple? The Eclipse keyword colored stuff is basically template language keywords. Okay, here you define a template, here you open a file. This is a for each statement, which, surprise, surprise, iterates over a bunch of attributes and then does something for each of them. And the black stuff is either names, references to meta classes, or expressions. So the thing about this template language is that it's object-oriented, okay? Because every template has a name, and it is associated with a meta class, right? The meta class is from your meta model, and the other crap is available here by a code completion. And the thing is that if you execute such a template by calling it, then there is an implicit variable called this, which refers to an instance of the meta class for which the template is defined. So that's why inside the template, it's really like a method for a meta class. Then, of course, you have the complete OCL-ish expression language to, navigate the model and, in this case, you know, iterate over all the attributes. If I only wanted to iterate over the attributes that whose name starts with an A, okay, I could write like select and then E dot name starts with A, okay, and so on. One important thing that we noticed is that, of course, what happens is that you have some of these expressions repeated all through the code, and that's bad. If you have the same expression in many places, you want to modularize. So that's where extension files come in. Let's just go here, for example. An extension file is basically a file which contains a number of functions, where a function is, well, a name, and then the meta class for which it is defined, and then an expression. Okay? It's basically a way to factor out expressions from your templates into separate functions, which you then can call from your templates or from anywhere else. We have type inference here, so you don't have to specify the return type. You can even call those functions recursively. In that case, of course, you have to specify the return type. So it's a good practice to factor out as many of the potentially complex expressions from the template language into these extension files, just to modularize things nicely. Okay, what else do we have? The template language itself is quite simple. You have the for each stuff, right? You have an if. You can define templates. You can define files. And that's basically it. There isn't much more. All the power basically lies in the expressions that are used inside those templates or that you factor out into extensions. The third thing I briefly want to mention is what we call workflows. It's unfortunately still an XML specification that we're about to change at some point, perhaps, maybe. And this is used to orchestrate the processing of a model in a kind of batch mode. So what this does is basically it calls the generated parser for our language, reads the model file that we parse here, that we pass in right through this property here, and then puts the parsed the AST that has been built from that parsing process into what we call a workflow slot. It's basically a global variable. Okay, there is a hash map behind it, and then you can basically sequence sets a number of components. Like first you read the model, then you delete the stuff in the target directory, and then you call the generator. And, of course, you can put other stuff here, like transform the model into something else, generate a visualization, whatever. Okay? So this is basically a way of scripting the actual execution of a generator based on what we call workflow components, which are, of course, pre-built for generation and parsing and stuff. So that's that. Let's go back here. Seems I'm actually going to finish on time. I'm surprised. So we've seen basically what I wanted to show. Let's briefly revisit going back to 10,000 feet and look at the Eclipse modeling tools and give you a little bit of an overview, what you've seen and how it relates to the other stuff, so you get the big picture after you've seen the details. So in Eclipse, there is this Eclipse modeling project, which is the umbrella project that contains everything modeling, right, and code generation and all that stuff that has to do with modeling. And then inside that, there is EMF, the Eclipse Modeling Framework. It's different than the Eclipse Modeling Project. Okay, that's the Eclipse Modeling Framework. Also, EMF also stands for Ed Merck's framework because he built it and still maintains it. And it contains a number of things. The important thing is it contains a meta-meta model, which is basically a formalism for defining abstract syntaxes for your language. Okay, and that's called ECORE. So you've seen the meta model that had been derived from the grammar. That is an instance of ECORE. It's a meta model for meta models, and that's why it's a meta meta model. We can get all philosophical about the meta 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 stuff, which nobody cares about. So then there is GMF, which is the graphical modeling framework, which allows you to build box and line editors. That's not one of those editors. That's the process of how to build it. The way you do it is you specify the meta model, your abstract syntax, and then you specify basically a mapping model that maps those domain abstractions two graphical notations that you specify in yet another model, and then you specify what's called a tool model, which basically defines how the palette, you know, the thing, the tool palette on the side looks. You can build quite nice editors with this stuff, but it's a lot of work, and I would argue that GMF has failed because it's at the wrong abstraction level. It's too complicated. It's not optimized enough for efficiently building graphical editors for typical DSLs. But that's, I mean, this is politics. You can't say that at Eclipse, okay? So then for textual editors, you have TMF, which is the textual editing framework or textual modeling framework. And what you have just seen for building textual languages is Open Architecture's Xtext, which is a framework for building textual editors that is currently being rewritten under the name Eclipse TMF. Okay, so the new version of what you've seen is going to be Eclipse TMF. History is that Open Architecture has a long time ago been a project outside of Eclipse. It has migrated into Eclipse, and now parts of it are moving into other Eclipse modeling, you know, sub-projects and stuff. And the textual DSL stuff is now moving into the Eclipse TMF project. There is model-to-model stuff, where you can create, well, new models from old models. And there is especially what's called ATL, the Atlas Transformation Language. And there is implementations of the QVT standard, that's OMG's Query View Transformation stuff. And then you've also seen, when we looked at the visualization, that was also model-to-model transformation done with OAW's Open Architecture's Extend language, which is not officially an Eclipse model-to-model transformation language, because for political reasons, we couldn't get that in. So OAW's model-to-model facilities are part of the model-to-text environment, because we kind of sneaked it in under the radar. Yes? Well, you've seen the extend model-to-model stuff. I don't show these.
Okay.
I mean, I could. I have them on my machine, at least ATL, but not in, you know, I didn't prepare anything.
Okay.
So and then Open Architecture, what's that? It's, as we like to say, a one-stop toolkit for DSLs. It has and the stuff you need to do with it, like code generation, transforming models. The current version is 4.3.1, and it's all the propaganda stuff. The thing is that it has existed for, in different versions, of course, for at least 5 years, and it's really used, at least in Europe, quite extensively. I would argue it's the most widely used framework for model-driven development for external DSLs. Not sure if that's true in America, but, well, that might change, hopefully. And the next, well, it has all these things for validating models, and you know, we can also work with UML models if somebody is so inclined for whatever reason, okay? If you think you can do something useful with UML, you can do it. And then there is OAW5, that's the next version, which, among other things, contains this completely new rewritten Xtext, which is now called Eclipse TMF. Right? The problem with Eclipse modeling is that it's this huge zoo of stuff where nobody knows how it fits together. Nobody knows what the maturity level of the various tools is, except the guys who write it. And so the problem is always, if you go to Eclipse modeling, which of these things do you actually use to do something useful? And what OAW wants to do is basically be a collection of stuff that works, that is integrated, that is documented as one thing, and that works together. I recently was at a customer last week. They worked with ATL and MOF script for code generation. I did a two-day OAW thing, and on the afternoon of the second day, they basically said, okay, stop it. You've convinced us. We give up. We're going to use OAW. It's clearly the best powerful thing there is in the Eclipse world. I'm not saying it's globally the best. Yeah.
Is it available to get a download of the whole thing in one shot right now?
Yeah. So there is a download with all of OAW that you can put in your Eclipse, but there is also a complete Eclipse distribution that contains EMF and GEF and GMF and OAW, which is all the stuff you need to run OAW. If you go to oaw.itemis.de, you can get the whole 300 megabyte modeling distribution. OAW dot, well, I can write it down once I've, okay, that's it. Question.
We still have 5 more minutes.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. Sorry, I can go back. Okay, so, questions.
Is there any kind of, what's available on this, or is it just online? What's
the there is about 300 pages of documentation, a bunch of screencasts and stuff, and a very active forum that you can use. There isn't a book that's dedicated for OAW. There is a rumor that some colleagues of mine are writing one in German, but that rumor has been around for a long time. The MDD book that I wrote a couple of years ago contains a bunch of examples with OAW, but it's outdated. So if you want the conceptual stuff, read my book. If you want the tutorial, go to the website, download the PDF.
Which website?
Openarchitecture.org. More questions? Yeah?
Can you speak to refactoring towards OAW? Because
from where?
From a mess
the Eclipse massive Antler files and the Eclipse CMF.
Okay.
Right. I guess the short answer is you have to redo everything. I mean, we can look at it in more detail, you know, after. But the point is, there is no specific tool support that there is that you can automate things in any way. More questions? Yeah.
You mentioned that the check is also migrating to Eclipse.
Yes.
Where is it going to end up?
It's going to be part of expand of the entity. So the thing is that it's all going to be under this expand umbrella, so that nobody, you know, cares. Because officially it would need to go into the EMF validation thing, and we also have an adapter to run check constraints as part of the e-validator Eclipse stuff. The rest is politics.
So they are programmatically available, not just
for you. Yeah, of course, absolutely. Yeah. Yes?
On your point on the graphical input, is that more a point about building the grammar or people using the grammar?
So from my perspective, the biggest problem is actually building the editors. That's why I like doing textual stuff. The other thing, whether it's better for users, depends on the user. I mean, there are certain things, state machines, that are better graphically. No discussion. You can do them graphically. Martin, you showed that yesterday. I showed an example. Of course you can. But in case of state machines, I think graphically is better. So it's a trade-off between what is really better, what's the effort to build things. But also, I think for the majority of stuff you want to describe in models, textual is really better for the user after a certain, you know, learning time. Because people always think if you show something as pictures, it's easy to understand, at least if they look like UML, right? And I think that's bullshit. I mean, as the abstractions need to be aligned with the domain, and then it doesn't matter. And if people, I mean, since we're talking about it, right, if you use UML and you use a stereotyped UML, profiled UML thing, it looks as if you would understand it because it looks like a class diagram. But it means something completely different. So you have to learn it anyway. So I think textual is the way to go with visualization.
Thanks very much, Marcus.